From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The American circus was a dazzling, dusty, roaring spectacle in its heyday. Clowns and acrobats and elephants and scale. But the circus is older than that and newer. Duncan Wall went to circus school, learned the art, the history, and the roots that now give us Cirque du Soleil. This hour on Point, the evolution of the circus. You can join the conversation. What are your circus memories, your circus dreams? Do you vote Barnum and Bailey or Cirque du Soleil? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me today from New York is Duncan Wall, author of The Ordinary Acrobat, a journey into the wondrous world of the circus past and present. It's part memoir about his time in circus school, part history of the circus. He teaches circus history and criticism at the National Circus School of Montreal, studied at the National School of Circus Arts in France. Duncan Wall, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
It's great to have you. So here's the classic intro. Let's see where it falls in your universe. The famous circus opening is heard from Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, welcome to the greatest show on earth!
Duncan Wall, that I guess is not your favorite circus.
It's funny. It's a bit like the music that you played coming in, the March of the Gladiators. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's such a part of our understanding of the circus historically and of the kind of voice of the circus in our head, right? When we think of the circus, we think of that ringmaster's voice.
Yeah.
We hear that music, and it really evokes something for us. It's not necessarily representative of the circus today, but it's still powerful, and it's kind of amazing that it is.
We've got people who are so nuts about that traditional circus, you know, who are still, when they see that the circus is coming to town, I think history still speaks to them. The old real canvas tents and elephants coming down the street and the dust and just the whole sort of exotic excitement of it. You write at the beginning of this huge exploration of the circus that you were not particularly, bitten by that bug when you were a kid.
Yeah, I never, and it's funny in retrospect now that I do have such a respect for that tradition now. But as a kid, I went to a few circus shows. I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri. We had the kind of classic touring circuses that came to the arena. I remember going to one or two with my family, seeing them from a distance, you know, sitting at the seats at the top of the arena, seeing the trapezists, the tigers in their cages. It's funny because not only did I not really attach to it, but I don't even remember thinking about it all that much. I remember thinking about movies, and I remember thinking about the internet. But the circus felt like something from almost like a previous time. A bit, we used to watch Nick at Night on television when I was a kid. I remember with my parents, and it was a bit like that. It was something that I saw them responding strongly to, but didn't quite understand why.
You write in The Ordinary Acrobat that there was a reason for that. That as in your childhood, you were finding the circus, that form of the circus, in a kind of cultural trough. It was a long way from its heyday.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. I mean, the circus, at the end of the 19th century, and this is something that I discovered in my research and knew nothing about when I started kind of my exploration of the circus, it was everywhere. It was an art form that was as popular as Hollywood today. Circus stars were like Madonna. They were like professional athletes. It was really considered a major part of the culture. Over the course of the 20th century, it declined for various reasons, which we could talk about, most of which are cultural and technological. And by the time I experienced it in the early 80s, it was almost seen as an art on the way out. And when I say that, I really do mean out for good, like vaudeville. You know, today the idea of a contemporary vaudeville, it exists, but nobody really knows about it. And it looked as though the circus was going that way as well.
One of the things I like about your description is that it's quite a global description. Was the American circus in its heyday, P.T. Barnum and Bailey and Ringling and all that, when the train would come around, usually carrying all those animals and performers, and the great big top would go up and the big march and all that. Was that a peculiarly American style? Was that the global style of circus in the 19th century? Were there other styles going on then?
There were absolutely other styles. And it's fascinating to think about that style being so much And again, to refer back to the March of the Gladiators, that music you played, or the ringmaster voice. And it's funny because in my life in the circus, that you just even the way you just did it there, that's exactly the way everybody does it. Right? Yes. It comes up so often.
That Calliope.
Everybody can do that. Yeah, right. The Calliope too. But what's interesting is that that actually wasn't the roots of the circus. The circus didn't start there. And even after it developed there in America, it took a very different trajectory elsewhere. Just to give one example, in Paris, for instance, the circus became a highbrow art form that was actually attached to equestrianism over the course of the second half of the 19th century. So, the aristocrats would literally on say, Wednesday go to the ballet. And they would watch the ballerinas in their tutus performing beautiful dance acts. And then on Thursday, they would go to the circus. And the circus, they would see essentially equestrian ballerinas, so women dressed in tutus. They would see acrobats dressed in kind of tuxedos. They themselves would wear tuxedos and dresses. And they would experience the circus that way. It was, I came across a great description of the Shah of Persia came to Paris once in the late 19th century, and he, it's good as his schedule. And so in the afternoon he goes to the Louvre, and in the evening he goes to the circus. It was considered, and it was the Cirque de Champs-Élysées.
Yes.
It was the Champs-Élysées as we think of it, except it was the circus representation of that. And that ultimately continued in Paris and in other cities. The other thing I should mention is the circus at that point was in buildings, right? So when you went to the circus, you weren't going to a tent like we think of. You would go to something that looked like an opera house, right? It was a beautiful, well-constructed, well-designed building where you would see your circus show with velvet seats and the beautiful chandelier over the ring and the sense of a real extravagance.
But no elephants pooping in the aisle.
Not in the aisle. It was funny because they would have elephants, right? They would have fewer than in the kind of big American circuses, but they would have kind of animal acts. But even those were done in a kind of refined way, right? It was, again, think of the difference between a horse being trained crudely in the kind of Wild West way and then the equestrianism of that we see in the Olympics today.
Well, crudely, you say. The American in me says, what do you mean? American Western riding. It leaves me wondering when you look at the spectrum of what can be called a circus, it's pretty broad. And I wonder what's at the heart of it. I mean, you quote from David Lewis Hammerstrom's Circus Rings Around Russia. You've got a lot of reach here. He quotes, I guess, and you quote the Russian historian Victor Kalish, and he gives a model for the circus. He says it consists of, one, an artistic model of festival atmosphere, two, ideal mastership or prowess. I guess that's juggling or acrobatics or trapeze, whatever it may be. Three, a wholeness, a feeling of a complete show that combines separate acts. That's still pretty broad, but is that a formula you can run with?
I think so, yeah. I mean, the funny thing about talking about the circus today is even if I were to ask, you or my mother, right, what she thinks about when she thinks about the circus, what comes to mind are the codes and the cliches, right? You think of a clown, you think of a ringmaster, you think of that doot-doot-doot-doot-doot-doot-doot, the song we toot. You could say that the circus is something much bigger, and it's a type of experience, right? And that's what he's saying there, is it's not, when we think of the circus, we shouldn't necessarily think of those specific codes that we attach with this specific type of circus.
Right.
We should think of something broader. We should think of, the Roman Colosseum, right, might have been a kind of circus experience. A fairground in the Middle Ages might have been a kind of circus experience. One could maybe argue that, going to a football game today has a kind of circusness about it.
Yes, yes. It's certainly got the wholeness. It's got separate acts. When Beyonce's in the middle of it, it's got even more separate acts.
There it is.
You talk about Kalish. You say, by his definition, the games of Rome were one of the greatest circuses in history. There were staged animal hunts and equestrian demonstrations. Not all that goes over so well these days. Jugglers milled in the corridors. Rope walkers balanced over the crowds in Rome, the Roman Colosseum, known as the amphitheater, but also another type, they're the elliptical, like modern football stadiums, with a spine down the middle for chariot races. They called them circuses.
Yeah, you had, and that's what's kind of, I didn't know that when I first started researching. And I should mention too that I'm not a circus historian. There are people who know way more than I do about circus history. One of the things that I discovered from my mentors there was that in Rome, there was the Roman amphitheater, which is round. And then there was an ovular building called the Circus. And you know, we think of that famous phrase, bread and circuses, mm-hmm. Which was something a Roman emperor said. And the circus he was referring to was like an ovular track that you might have seen in the movie Ben-Hur, right, mm-hmm. where you had chariot sure. races going around. And the word circus actually comes from that notion of going around. So going around and around.
Of course, circus.
Yep. And when we talk about it, you know, when people try to define circus, there are those who say, you know, that you cannot have a circus without a ring, right? Simply because the word circus itself, right, comes from this notion of going around. And there's right. something inherent about the idea of a ring and about sitting across from people, right? About seeing the other spectators
yes,
as part of the show.
Their faces agog at what's going on before
exactly.
all of you. Duncan yeah. Wall's new book is The Ordinary Acrobat, A Journey into the Wondrous World of the Circus, Past and Present. I learned a lot. Among the things I learned, Duncan, the leotard, named after a French circus guy, Jules Leotard, who also inspired The Man in the Flying Trapeze, the music behind us right here. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Now this young man by name was Signor Bonnieslag, tall, big and handsome, as well made as chain. Where'er he appeared, the hall loudly rang with ovation from all people there. He'd smile from the bar on the people below, and one night he smiled on my love. Ah, she winked back at him, and she shouted bravo as he hung from his nose up above. Oh, he flies through the air with the greatest of ease, this daring young man on that flying trapeze. His movements are graceful, all girls does he please, and my love, he's purloined it away.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the circus path, the evolution from Barnum and Bailey to Cirque du Soleil. My guest, Duncan Wall, has studied circus arts and history, and he's here to tell the tale. His new book is The Ordinary Acrobat, A Journey into the Wondrous World of the Circus, Past and Present. 1996, Le Cri du Chameleon, or The Cry of the Chameleon, was one of the first contemporary French circus performances that pushed a new wave of high art circus. And here are the sounds of acrobats in that performance jumping off the catapult, up in the air, catching a hanging rope. So, Duncan, you describe in the 70s, you were a kid looking at the circus, not too impressed, but something else was regaining its footing then that eventually led to something like Cirque du Soleil. What was that?
Yeah. So as part of the social and political movements of the 60s, you began to see theater performers interested in engaging with their audiences through popular techniques. So in America, we had like the Bread and Puppet Theater, which was a theater company in, I believe it was Vermont, that created these massive puppets as part of the protests. You had in San Francisco something called the San Francisco Mime Company, which did similar things, tried to use, again, popular theater techniques to engage with people. And as part of that same revolution, people became interested in circus techniques because they figured out that, you know, if you went into a plaza, for instance, and you started juggling three balls, mm-hmm. you could very quickly draw a crowd.
Yes.
And then with that crowd, you could say things. And from that, then there began to develop this new wave of what we call new circuses, which were circuses that basically incorporated theater and dance, did away with some of the codes we were talking about earlier.
The ringmaster and the red jacket and all that.
That's
the
right.
High boots.
Yep, the March of the Gladiators, the song, all of that, mm-hmm. And in favor of something more potentially complex, potentially more subtle. It was basically the idea of including story, including characters, including meaning. Right, because mm-hmm. when you think about the circus before, you think about seeing a show, you see an acrobat,
mm-hmm.
spectacle, right? But it's spectacle without meaning. It's you watch a person do a backflip, and you're impressed with how amazing that backflip was. You're impressed with all the time they put into it. You're impressed with their ability as a human being, but they're not really saying anything with that backflip, right? They're not expressing themselves creatively. This new circus aspired to do something like that, right?
More like theater or drama.
Exactly like theater or drama. And the idea was then to be using circus as not just a way of demonstrating what we as people are capable of, but a way of our expressing ourselves, of making it really an art. And you begin to see at that point, there are things happen like the French Minister of Culture, for instance, who until that point had kept the circus in its Department of Agriculture or Ministry of Agriculture, right, because of the animals, then moved it to the Ministry of Culture, right, with this idea that, oh, wait, like the circus actually is this complete form. It's been around for thousands of years, and we've thought about it as this kind of low demonstration of skill, but in fact, it's a really creative art.
How does Cirque du Soleil come out of that? I mean, you may find meaning there. On the other hand, they're very popular in Vegas, which we don't associate with high theater.
Sure, yeah. Cirque du Soleil emerged in the 80s. The founders of Cirque du Soleil saw what was happening in Europe, where a lot of this was beginning. They brought that model over to North America, and then they began to grow it, essentially. And it became, you know, the story of Cirque du Soleil is a fascinating story of this group of fire breathers and stilt walkers becoming, you know, billionaires today. And largely, though, that story is built on this notion of the new circus, right? When you go to a Cirque du Soleil show, it might not be the same as seeing a piece of avant-garde German theater, right? Mm-hmm. But you are seeing a show with story, and you're seeing a show with characters, and you have an emotional resonance with what you're experiencing that is slightly different than the emotional resonance you have with a kind of traditional circus.
You have personal experience here. You came to France in college and ended up enrolling in the French, what's it called, National School of Circus Arts?
Yeah.
Describe those for us. I mean, the sort of circus arts. What are those?
Sure. And I should say, too, that my trajectory here was I discovered the contemporary circus as a student in college. Mm-hmm. And the book describes all of this. It describes kind of my getting sucked into this circus world and my becoming
exactly
the person that I'm talking – that I'm speaking as right now.
but you weren't the one who ran away to join that dusty cavalcade and scoop behind the elephants and do anything just to be part of the hurly-burly. It was more this – the finer art of circus that attracted you.
Exactly. Yeah, and I grew up as an athlete. I was the captain of my soccer team. I did some martial arts, and I also grew up as a kind of artist. Like I loved literature. I did writing. I had an attachment to there. I felt that kind of expressiveness. And when I think that, you know, and this is all in retrospect, but I think that when I discovered the circus, I discovered something that massaged both sides of my soul, you know, to speak about it grandly. Like I found that there was this thing that was at once artistic and expressive and creative and was physical and visceral and kind of almost brutal at times. And so I applied for a fellowship and ended up going to study at the School for Circus Arts in France. The School for Circus Arts in France. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating because it really is an artistic school. Like the students study acrobatics, they study juggling, they study the circus arts themselves, right? But they also study acting, they study dancing, they study sculpture, they study philosophy. There's really this notion of cultivating them not just as performers, as physical performers, not just as gymnasts, but as creators, as people who can speak through the circus and who ideally have something to say through the circus.
Some of the things that we see performed in the refined circus, Cirque du Soleil, I mean, some of the physical things are just incredible. Does this school take people to that highly, highly refined physical performance?
It's funny. It really depends on the school itself. So there are now professional circus schools that have emerged all over the world and continue to emerge. The schools have their different emphases, right? Some schools are kind of put a greater emphasis on the creative side. Other schools are more technically superior. So, for instance, like the school in the Ukraine is incredible in terms of the technical performance they create. Mm-hmm. But it's a balance that the schools try to strike, and it's a balance that comes from their notion of what is satisfying in the circus, right? Do we go to the circus to see somebody do a triple backflip in a kind of precise, immaculate way? Or do we go to see somebody express themselves through physicality, almost more like dance? And that's a tension that exists in the circus world. I mean, there's a tension. There's a difference between where I teach it in Montreal and in France, where I studied, and in Sweden and in Africa and in South America. I mean, it's each culture has their own circus now.
We've got a lot of circus history going on here today, and a lot of circus right now in the world of many different stripes. Duncan Wall is with us. His big new book is The Ordinary Acrobat, A Journey into the Wondrous World of the Circus. Tom's calling from Plainfield, New Hampshire. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
I was calling because I recently have become very enamored with this whole topic of circuses because I just bought a calliope that was built in 1926 for Ringling Brothers.
Wow.
It was their first
cool
air-driven calliope. They used to use steam-driven calliopes. And so I bought it on a lark. It was my midlife crisis.
Amazing. What's it look like? Is it on wheels? Is it mobile?
Yes, it's in it's built on the frame of a 63 VW Bug, and it's built to look like a circus.
Wow.
You pull it down the highway on those two wheels, and then you drop down the front wheels, and you could have it be in a parade, and you unfold it all, and it looks very circusy, red and gold and all that.
So
and
it's got, does it have an air compressor that's blowing the air through to make all that tootling happen?
Yes, it has a constant air-driven pump in it, and it can run on battery or it runs on AC or DC.
Wow.
And so I'm really curious about the evolution of music, because I bought it I want to think outside the box with it. Instead, I mean, it there's plenty of call for it in you know, the traditional parade and the 4th of July parade and
yeah,
those kinds of things. But I mean, if it were up to me, I'd drag it out to Burning Man Festival or something like
that. Yeah, please. Sounds great. Hey, Tom, we'll go to your question, Tom, but how do people respond when you open up your midlife crisis and pull it down the street?
Well, it's fascinating. When I bought it from the guy, I promised him that it would stay. It would not go to a museum. It is meant to be played.
Yeah.
Kids are allowed to come and play it and press the keys down and hear the tooting, and because it's really important that stay alive, a live instrument, and the evolution of the music is what intrigues me about where songs like Guns and Blazes, Thunder and Blazes, which is commonly mm-hmm. called March of the Gladiators,
right,
is very, very fascinating to me, and that's part of the reason I wanted to buy it, was to expand its goal and have it be not only in parades and circuses, but to be out there in films or someone using it in music.
Yeah.
I mean, the mm-hmm. the song The Benefit of Mr. Kite by the Beatles was they couldn't find a real Calliope, so George Martin took an old 78 recording of Calliope music and recorded it, literally cut the tape up into little pieces, and the engineer reassembled it. And
there we had it. Oh, remember it well. These days, just call Midlife Crisis Tom in Plainfield, New Hampshire. It's great that you raised the theme of circus music, and we'll picture you at Burning Man, Tom, with your Calliope. But Duncan, what about the music here? The origin of Calliope music, first of all, and circus music more generally? It's evolution.
First, if I could say to Tom, too, that I think they would love him at Burning Man.
Yeah.
There's a big circus scene at Burning Man, and
guys
they
on
might
stilts
just be looking
and
for
all
a
that.
Yeah. It's, the interesting thing about everything related to the circus is because the circus was practiced as a commercial enterprise for a long time, right? It was a business mm-hmm. first.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that developed around the circus, especially in America, was created for commercial purposes. So, like, when you think of the Calliope, like, why, you know, and this is when you start to delve into circus history, it becomes fascinating. Like, why is the Calliope the circus instrument? Like, why do we associate that instrument with this one art form? And the answer is because when you have a parade, right, you need an instrument that's mobile.
Yeah.
And you need an instrument that's really, really loud.
Big sound.
And that you can, attract people from all over. And so the Calliope was that.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing a bit with the accordion, right? It's like mm-hmm. an accordion instrument that you can play. You can take it into a room and you can have a party, right? You mm-hmm. can attract people. And it's mobile. So, you know, as circus and music has evolved, and of course, that's the kind of traditional circus music. In the new circus music, anything can be musical, right? Anything can be part of the circus music. But when you look at the tradition, there's often a kind of practical component to it.
When you come all the way up again to Cirque du Soleil, and it's not as if that's the only contemporary brand of circus, but it's one everybody knows, there's almost a techno association with that. What's that about? Where did that theme come from?
I think, you know, it's sort of a world beat kind of
mm-hmm.
thing, right? Like, I think it was their effort to be international, right? Mm-hmm. To be kind of something that was outside of a specific given culture. Like, you hear Cirque du Soleil music and you don't think it's like, oh, this is not Russian music or
true.
Not French
go
music.
Go anywhere, it's, play in Singapore yeah. or in San Francisco. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like Cirque du Soleil itself. It's hard to pin it down. And I also think it's an attempt to be contemporary, right? Like, a lot of what the contemporary circuses does is it takes the circus as a form, as a kind of raw art form, and then tries to apply everything that is contemporary to it. So it tries to speak to modern problems, to our modern world, to express mm-hmm. ourselves and the modernity in which we live. And that modernity might not be a Calliope anymore, right? It might be actually what we heard in that clip you played, a kind of like broken horn or some kind of like violin that's a bit rugged. It might be techno.
All kinds of threads woven through the history of the circus, some very fine, some vulgar, everything. Beth in Middlebury, Vermont. Beth, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to talk a little about what made a big impression to me when I was a youngster, being taken to the circus at Madison Square Garden. My sister took me to the sideshows, and she let me go look at the Lobster Boy all by myself. And it was rather a poignant experience for me.
Mm-hmm.
The Lobster Boy was, I guess, what you would consider now a thalidomide baby. I couldn't tell how old he was, but he had fingertips coming from his shoulders and toes coming from where his thigh would be starting.
Yeah.
And I went down there expecting, I went into that exhibit expecting it to be a trick or a costume.
Yeah.
I was only 6 or 7 years old, and I thought, oh, you know, clowns aren't really clowns. They're in a costume. And
I
looked down in that pit. There was a platform, a circular platform that you could look down on this person. I realized he was a person. He was a person. He was dressed only in a diaper so that you could see his arms and his, what would have been his arms and his legs.
Beth, we've got the picture, Beth, and our time is short before the break. Let me pick it up, because this whole sideshow element and the sort of shocking and sad side of it, I had an experience like that myself, Beth, as a kid. You know, the signs out front on the sideshows look amazing and colorful, and inside is something much closer to tragedy, or certainly in any case, you know, somebody up against real physical challenges. Duncan, what about the sideshow tradition in the circus? Where'd that come from?
Yeah, that was brought in the 19th century. Initially, for the first 100 years, the circus did not have sideshow acts. In America, they basically became popular and they were brought into the circus. Elsewhere, they weren't. One of the scenes in the book is, I remember my discovery of, you know, because when I thought of circus, I thought of sideshow too. And and my kind of historical mentor, a historian named Pascal Jacob, saying to me, you know, in Europe, we don't associate the circus with the sideshow. That's not at all our conception of the art. In fact, we associate that with the fairgrounds. And so, you know, that's, again, if we're talking about reputation, the fact that we have that specific, the experience that Beth has just described, attached to this notion of the art form dictates how we feel about the art form and how we respond to it. And again, that's unique to America.
You write about P.T. Barnum, of course, out of Connecticut, and how he really pushed this kind of big spectacle show. You write here, ultimately colossal, crassly commercial, bamboozling, inspiring, populist, simplistic, joyful, that three-ring show of spectacular overabundance that dominated the American entertainment landscape in the 19th century. And then came the sideshow as well. Beth, I'm glad you raised that. That was a hard side, a hard face sometimes of the circus. Duncan Wall takes it all kinds of places. Music behind us right here from Cirque du Soleil, Alegria. The performance debuted in 1994. It's been seen by 10 million people, more than 65 cities. We're talking about the evolution of the circus. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the circus path evolution from Barnum and Bailey to Cirque du Soleil and much more. My guest, Duncan Wall, has studied circus arts and history. He's here to tell the tale. Behind us right there, the clowning group Le Nouveau Né, one of the most popular contemporary clowning groups in France, singing last year, a different stripe of circus. Duncan Wall's book is The Ordinary Acrobat, A Journey into the Wondrous World of the Circus Past and Present. He went to circus school in France, where it's not exactly Barnum and Bailey these days. All kinds of history and flavors of circus in the world. Here's a little bit from a 2012 performance of the French clowns Le Plus Grand Cabernet du Monde, or the biggest cabaret in the world. Here we go.
Ça marche bien.
Duncan, paint the picture for us. What's going on there? That sounds familiar.
Yeah, I mean, it's the sort of classic. You know, I mean, Clowning's Day is much broader than the kind of red-nosed comedy. It's something almost more like a Laurel and Hardy, like a stand-up, or like a specific, you know, kind of physical banter that you can do. And that's what they're doing there.
And remind us, Jules Leotard, I didn't know leotards were named after a man. You know, who knew that all the, you know, girls in their dance classes and guys in gymnastics? Who was Jules Leotard?
He was. He created the flying trapeze in the 1850s. He was the first trapezist. What makes him interesting, and actually at that point, the trapezes were used in gymnastics, right? So you would do pull-ups on the bar. You would sit on the bar and do exercises. Mm-hmm. He was the first one to kind of, you know, turn it into the flying trapeze we know. He became a fascinating international star. And these are, in terms of my journey into circus history, a lot of what I discovered was that there are these characters that, you know, have these kind of crazy stories, and I try to recount a number of them in the book. And in his case, he comes to Paris, you know, he's 22 years old. And again, this is 19th century. People have never, you know, maybe there are hot air balloons at this point, right? The idea of somebody flying in the air, flying through the air is extreme, right? Mm-hmm. And Jules is this good-looking guy from Toulouse, and he's tan, and he's buff, and he's now flying over the crowd, and the women just went nuts. They went absolutely crazy. Yeah. He published his memoirs a year after his premiere, and it's basically just like a list of love letters of women that he's received from women, sort of inviting him to meet them at the hotel at 2 o'clock. Yeah. And, you know,
in his leotard, perhaps.
Yes, in his leotard, right? And so the word leotard actually comes from the outfit that he created for himself to be able to fly through the air easily.
If you want to be, you know, the magnificent man or woman on the flying trapeze these days, where do you go? Where's the peak of that pyramid of circus arts these days?
Yeah. I mean, what's fascinating, and this is actually something I'd really like to stress, is that in the circus arts today, there's the kind of performance revolution that we're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. Which is this notion of, you know, evolving circus away from the kind of cliches that we associate it with. But there's also the circus has opened in another way, right? It's completely accessible to everyone. And this is what I discovered in terms of my experience in France, but the same is equally true in America. There are over 200 circus schools now.
Wow.
There are literally in France, there are 600 circus schools, right? There are new schools being created every year. The American Youth Circus Organization, which is a really important network of circus organizations, is growing and growing every year. And the idea and the reason that happened is because in the 70s, and again, in 1970, there were zero circus schools in the world, zero, right? And now there are hundreds and hundreds.
What happened, it was passed on by families in those days, and now...
Exactly. Yep. For literally thousands of years, the circus arts were handed down from father to son or mother to daughter. It was really a almost like a lineage, the way a craftsman would pass down their craft to their child. In the 70s, first actually in Soviet Russia, they created a national school in the 20s, mm-hmm. but they kind of stayed behind the Iron Curtain. In the 70s, it exploded in the West. And since then, you've seen this fluorescence of circus arts as an amateur activity all over the world. So now, you know, everybody listening in their communities can go engage in an aerial class, right? Which is a piece of fabric that hangs from the ceiling. You could learn to juggle. You can be doing acrobatics. There's a movement called social circus, which is using circus arts for social good. There's an organization in Chicago called Circus Team that works with a lot of kids from the inner city to give them, show them how to trust people, how to work with other people, cooperation, gives them a sense of self-esteem because they learn a skill that they can then perform for the public. It's really blowing up all over, and it's actually quite powerful, the effects of the circus.
So when our listeners write, as Karina does here, sometimes I still want to run away with the circus, she writes, that can be done. There are schools all over the place to find entree.
Yeah, and you don't even need to, I mean, if, you know, to a young listener, like you can run away and have a career in the circus. There are absolutely avenues for that. But even for older listeners, like I know a trapezist in an aerialist in Philadelphia who's 70 years old, and she just decided, and it was maybe her midlife crisis, right? She decided she wanted to be physical and also be expressive. And so she decided to find a circus school, and she did. And I mean, that's the thing, is you can have, you know, time after work today, you could go take a circus class, right? And it could be your kind of Friday night thing, right?
Sure. Me, Ariel. I love it.
Yeah, do it. Let's do it.
Let's get a call from Harrison in Stores Mansfield, Connecticut. University of Connecticut, UConn. Harrison, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Duncan. Hi. Yeah. I heard you guys were talking about this on the radio yesterday, and I was like, I got to make sure I listen to this one.
Good.
Cool.
I just this summer graduated from the New York Goose Clown School, and I was curious to ask you, Duncan, how my girlfriend, she just actually finished a 3-year run with Love in Las Vegas as Lady Madonna, and we're both at school right now, and we have a year left, and we're trying to figure out what we want to do. And I keep going back to the circus saying, you know, you come from Cirque, I'm a clown, we should really think about pursuing this in some sort of way. And I was wondering what your advice is to younger performers trying to really break back in or break into the circus life, how to go about that. Or
love it. Yeah, love it. We got it here. It's a career advice for the circus bound. How about it, Duncan?
That's a great question. I mean, there are a couple options. I mean, one is there is a kind of circus infrastructure, right? So if you wanted to get more training, you could look up other circus schools like we were talking about. Some are in America. The one I teach at is in Montreal. There are other schools in Europe. There's also this idea that, and this is something that we kind of as a circus community are really trying to support and develop in America, is the notion of creating professional circus work, right? Such that theaters now begin to feature more circus shows. And the kind of shows that they would feature, right, are exactly the kind of shows that maybe you would create, right? They would be a kind of a clown theater company. It would be something, you know, a spectacle that's also a piece of theater, that's also a piece of dance that is original, right? And that's one avenue that you could also go, would be just to begin saying, okay, like, you're a clown, you have some clown training. What do you want to say through clowning, right? Like, what speaks to you about that, and how do you want to talk to an audience? And then begin making work about that in the same way that, like, a dancer would or an actor would.
Harrison, do you want the smell of elephants along with your circus career, or is that not part of your dream?
Well, I'm actually a puppetry major here at UConn, so I'm really trying to incorporate all aspects of the theater. And that's what I was also wondering is, because there's a difference between circus clowning and theatrical clowning. And I'm curious about what you think is more being pushed towards more popular right now in the circus. Okay. It's either circus or more theatrical.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I mean, Duncan, I read you kind of looking to erase that line between circus clowning and theatrical clowning. Or am I wrong? I mean, I'm looking back here. You had a group called the Candidatos, and you described there it was clowning, but you described it as part Marx Brothers, part Coen Brothers, and part Cirque du Soleil.
Yeah, yeah.
Where's the line? Is there one?
It's complex. I mean, it's whether a clown is a circus clown or a theater clown. So traditionally, it depends on the environment, right? Like in a big circus, right, a big three-ring circus, clowns were forced to use certain techniques to communicate with the audience. In a small theater, or maybe even in a one-ring show like Cirque du Soleil, a clown can be more subtle, right? A clown can employ different techniques. One thing about theatrical clowning that's interesting is there's more text involved usually. So a clown will be, as we heard in that clip there, the clown will be talking and whatnot. But really, it's a clown, I would say, is not so much where a clown performs as how a clown performs. Like, how do you interact with the audience? What is your relationship to your own vulnerability and to your own relationship to the audience? The difference between a clown and an actor, right? One thing is that the clown is kind of addressing the audience directly and taking them on. Mm. And that can be in a circus, that can be in a theater, that can be in the street, that could be in your living room, that could be in a hospital, where clowns are starting to become more and more popular as a means of bringing joy into the lives of people who are suffering.
Circus all over. Harrison, good luck with your career path there. Adela in Milford, Connecticut. Adela, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you very much for listening to me. I loved your program. I always learn something.
Thank you. Today,
I'm from Spain, and in Europe, we see the circus always as I remember as a child. It was a part of art. It was an artistic part where it made you laugh, but also you get the best of the best in the arts of all the things that you see within the circus.
Yes.
Then I think that the Cirque du Soleil is bringing a little bit again what the circus was in Europe. That I know that to be in the Cirque du Soleil, they have the best of the best of the in the world. They look for them. They try to bring you the best to have the chance to observe what the art of any event, anything that you are seeing is. And I think they are, I'm happy to see that. I've been in the Cirque du Soleil, and reminds me that that is an art, what you're seeing. And unfortunately, there was a deviation with the American circus. It was another way of expressing this, the art of the circus.
Yes.
And I'm happy that they are bringing it back. Also, I know that in Europe it was inherited. I mean, your family was involved, and you would inherit the art of whatever you were doing, clowning or the way that they were danced or the...
Sure, generation after generation. Adela, you put that so well. I mean, we have some of that, of course, family tradition, the Walendas, Flying Walendas and more in the States as well, but deep history on that score in Europe when it comes to the art of the circus. And Adela, I appreciate that so much. Let me get one more right here, if I may. Charlie in Waynesboro, Virginia. Charlie, you're on.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Yes.
What I remember as a child about the circus here in rural Virginia is that that was the only exposure we got as children to see the wild animals, you know, apes and big cats and things. And when I was a child, my father owned a wholesale grocery warehouse. And when the circus would come to town, they would send a crew to the warehouse, and they would stock up on the staples of you know, what the traveling community needed to feed itself.
Yes.
And they didn't have to go to the grocery store.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And my father would always get a fistful of tickets. He'd pass out a few to the hardest working employees that he had.
Yeah.
But we would always go to the circus a few hours early, and the circus manager would kind of take us around on a sort of backstage pass, and we got to pet the elephants and the zebras and look at the workings of the circus kind of behind the tent.
Oh, Charlie, that must have been magical for a child.
Oh, as a child, it was just the high point of my summer to go to the circus and meet the people and talk to them and find out about their life. And
yeah, lucky boy, lucky man to have such memories. Mm-hmm. Charlie, thank you very much for bringing that back to us, bringing out the wholesale. I mean, and we all know how exciting that was to see all of those circus animals. But I must say, Duncan, we also have a lot of people writing online, a lot of listeners who are happy to see the animal part retreat in its prominence. So a lot of people who saw that as tough treatment on animals at the same time.
Yeah, and that's a complex and controversial issue in the circus is the role of animals. The way that a lot of contemporary circuses address that is either by not including animals, as with Cirque du Soleil, and that can be for moral reasons or economic reasons, mm-hmm. or including domesticated animals, right? So animals that the horses, dogs, animals that have kind of a long tradition of being mm-hmm. domesticated. The one thing I would note in terms of that, what Adele was saying earlier about the kind of European circus and the difference there is. We're actually trying now in America to help people understand the kind of range of the circus today and help them see the circus today. And to do that, we've created an organization called Circus Now. The website is www.circusnow.org. And we're doing events in 7 cities around the country to discuss and to present what the contemporary circus is in America. We have speakers, we have performances to show kind of the dynamism and the vibrancy and all of the people who are super passionate about this. One of the issues we'll be discussing is animals. We're also going to be discussing the role of things like empowerment through aerial work and social circus, which is circus for social good, which I was talking about before, and how to be creative through the circus. Our goal is really to keep this conversation that we're having right now and that the mm-hmm. listeners are wonderful engaging going and to keep talking about, you know, what is the circus today and is it an art form, and if so, how, and how can we be using it for more in America and show people its beauty and joy.
It's easy to imagine the new and the old still kind of wrestling together. It was on one of the network television news programs just very recently. I saw I think a little clip of an enormous bear on a high wire somewhere, Russia or China, I forget. I mean, those gaudier animal part keeps coming back in as well. How do you picture the circus evolving in its mainstream, if there's such a thing, in this next century? What do you think in the year 2113 people will look for when they go to the circus, Duncan?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think it's twofold. One is that at a certain point we will have shed our understanding of the circus as a of those codes, right, of the ringmaster and of the circus being a specific type of
whip
costume,
and the lion tamer,
right?
And
yeah. That we'll have an idea of it being a virtuosic performance, right, of being something beautiful and grand. But I also think that this amateur circus that we were talking about before, this idea that you on Friday night can be doing circus, that will just continue to explode. And we could see the circus being as mainstream, and I think this will happen actually, as mainstream as something like rock climbing or skateboarding or yoga, right? Something that people do because it feels good, because it allows them to use their body, and they can be expressive, and they can enjoy themselves while learning something new.
A little music behind us right here. This is James Tirrey. He's the grandson of Charlie Chaplin, one of the top contemporary circus performers in the world. In this performance, he roller skates and plays the violin. That's circus. Duncan Wall's book is The Ordinary Acrobat, A Journey into the Wondrous World of the Circus, Past and Present. Duncan, thank you very much for bringing all this together for us and joining us today. Thanks so much for being here.
A sincere pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Tomorrow in this hour, we will look at the city of Detroit. Forbes magazine calls it the most miserable city in America. What do you do with a city in that circumstance? We'll talk to Charlie the Duff, Detroiter. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.